Hello, I'm Mariëtte Snyman. Welcome to Calm, Clear and Helpful, a weekly podcast series on taking good care of yourself and others, introducing you to a wide range of wellness professionals ready to inform and inspire. Today's topic is solve insomnia and other sleep challenges with brain working recursive therapy. My guest is Mark Eaton, clinical psychologist and neuropsychologist from Gaybaga, also known as Port Elizabeth. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you, Mariëtte. It's really wonderful to be here. I'm excited to share some insights and some ideas on this interesting and very, very necessary topic.
Indeed. And to our listeners, after our conversation, Mark will give us three nice sleep tips, and then it will be fun question time. Mark, in our high-speed, high-tech society, do we see to it that we get adequate, high-quality sleep?
Well, you know, I think that we could all be attending to our sleep programs a lot more than we do. I think in this high-tech, as you say, society, there is constant pressure that we need to be doing more, we need to be attending to more. There are so many roles and responsibilities that we have these days, and I think one of the casualties is sleep. And unfortunately, sleep is so primary and so primal and such a necessary to our overall physical and emotional health that if it's a casualty, you know, all of those aspects suffer. And that's very, very sad.
Yeah, the first time I spoke to someone with expertise on sleep, it struck me how we really aren't very aware of, as you say, how basic it is to our health.
Absolutely. You know, we neglect it. And as human beings, we often forestall sleep. We find other things to occupy ourselves, things that are maybe healthy for us in some respects, like spending time with loved ones and communicating and being there and problem solving with others. Other times, sometimes things that are really contradictory to our general overall health, which is extended sessions of watching television or being on social media or, you know, gaming. You know, these days, there are a lot of people that are addicted to social media and gaming. And this keeps us awake and it keeps our brain as if on a sort of a Ritalin high. You know, all of those dopamine receptors in the brain are just firing away and we don't give ourselves a chance to wind down adequately. And that leads to the various sleep disorders of difficulty falling asleep, difficulty staying asleep, and even if one does all of those things, not necessarily sleeping for the correct duration, and then waking up and not having had a sense of restful sleep.
Yes, we'll look at those in more detail a little later. What I'd like to know first is in which ways do sleep disturbances affect us?
Yeah, well, they affect us in so many different ways. And, you know, I think we have to start with the physical. You know, the physical body takes strain if we're not getting adequate sleep. And by the way, there's a lot of debate as to how much is adequate sleep. And the general consensus tends to be about 7 to 9 hours of good continuous sleep. But without that, our body does not restore itself from a physical perspective. And that renders us much more prone to cardiovascular type problems, diabetes problems, as well as just aches and pains. And then also our immune functioning really, really can take a whole lot of strain if we're not getting that restorative sleep. So that's the one, you know, that's the physical. And, you know, from a psychological perspective, emotionally, our emotional regulation is really quite a lot contingent on the quality of our sleep. If we're not getting a good night's sleep, or if we're having nightmares or interrupted sleep, our sense of emotional stability and our ability to regulate our emotions in the day is significantly affected. You know, and when that happens, our interpersonal functioning can be thrown out of kilter. We come across grumpy, irritable, moody. That affects our loved ones, it affects our colleagues, it affects our clients with whom we interact. And then also another important part is our cognitive functioning. So our cognitive functioning is all of those aspects of concentration, attention, tracking what people are saying, being able to remember short-term memory, long-term memory, and also to organize what we're doing during the day. And so from an efficiency and a productivity point of view, those are the casualties. And you know what? The funny thing is people don't really realize that. And Mariette, I think that also speaks to what you were mentioning earlier on about we don't attend to the need to sleep as much as we should. And that's because people in a sleep-deprived state actually don't have insight that they are sleep-deprived and that their functioning is actually compromised. And when I say functioning, I mean their cognitive functioning, their speed of functioning, their efficiency, their judgment. It is all compromised relative to someone having had consistent, good duration and good quality of sleep.
That's very interesting. So one should perhaps ask one's significant other about how one is doing cognitively.
Well, yeah, you need that external feedback, you know, and I sometimes have to, for various neuropsychological testing on pilots or various professionals or for various insurance claims, I have to do computer testing of people's response time and their attention capabilities and their processing speed. And until you do those objective tests, you don't really know. But yeah, you know, the spouse is always a good litmus test. You know, am I grumpy? Am I not grumpy? Am I hearing you? Am I listening to you? And so getting a sort of all-round impact an assessment from the loved ones is part of it. But, you know, the thing is, we as humans miss things and we excuse things. And I think it's these sort of podcasts and this information that makes us stop and pause and actually really, you know, evaluate, are we doing what we need to be doing for our overall health? And how is our sleep? You know, what is the quality of my sleep? What am I doing to ensure that quality is not compromised? And one of the things is to realize that you could actually be much more productive if you do attend to sleeping. Sometimes people with a type A personality, they're so driven and they think, well, there's no time for sleep. I've just got to get all of these lists of things done. And, you know, there's no time to slow down. And it's not really a case of slowing down. It's a case of doing the right things so that your efficiency and competence is boosted.
Mark, could you mention some of the causes of sleep deprivation?
Yes, well, I think maybe again just to highlight that our choice is one of those causes of sleep deprivation. So we actively choose to do something other than going to bed at a regular sleep time. And so that's something that we can make a cognitive and conscious effort to change when one realizes the impact of that. But of course, you know, many other things impact on sleep, even in a person who is willing and wishing and wanting to go to sleep and get that restful night's sleep. And it's really, really important to just consider, like I always do, biopsychosocial factors. So when I'm talking about biofactors, there are various medical complaints, various medical conditions that can aggravate. And, you know, we can speak about that a little bit later if needs be. But just one of them is obstructive sleep apnea. And that is a fairly serious condition that many people don't realize that they have. And people should get tested for that. And Mariette, this is where the spouse test comes in handy, is if you're snoring and you don't realize it, and if you're waking up in the middle of the night and sort of, you know, choking mid-breath and your breathing is stopping and your spouse keeps elbowing you and telling you to turn over, that could be a sign of obstructive sleep apnea, which can cause a whole lot of physical and emotional as well as cognitive fallouts. So that's on the medical side of things. And when it comes to the psychological side of things, you know, stress, conflict, emotional difficulties, including, you know, the outplaying of those stress factors in the forms of various emotional disorders like anxiety as well as depression, they can really, really contribute and interrupt and perpetuate a very difficult relationship with sleeping. So that's the psycho. And then when one goes to the social, so we're still thinking in that domain, biopsychosocial, from a social perspective, you know, if one's doing too much and too many social activities, or actually not doing enough social activities, you know, you want to hit a sweet spot there. But if a person is not really in the sweet spot of knowing what stresses are good for them, moderating that with periods of good rest and sleep and good nutrition, all of those factors, those lifestyle factors, can impinge and start to rob them of the necessary sleep that is restorative and refreshing.
Yeah, I cannot resist, Mark, to say that one mustn't forget about babies as causes of sleep deprivation.
Absolutely. I was thinking that people don't know what sleep deprivation is until they have their first child. And my first child is, he's just last year turned 18, but we had a rough time. Now, my wife, I think, has less of a memory of that period of time, but yeah, absolutely. And there is no one so zombie-like as a person with a newborn, particularly when the baby is colicky and, you know, you're having to get up and attend to them and you do not know what you are doing, whether it is needing to change a nappy, whether it's they need more sleep and they're overstimulated, or they need to feed. It's a really confusing time. So for new parents out there, that sleep difficulty wouldn't necessarily constitute a sleep disorder. It's a sleep challenge. It's a sleep difficulty. And what I think helped me at that time is to remember, this too shall pass. Yeah. You know, this phase will pass. It's not going to be persistent and ongoing. But you know what? When you're in that mode, it just feels like it's never ending. So to have someone from outside remind the new parents that things will normalize, things will get back to a more normal period of sleeping and night-day circadian rhythms, then, you know, that's reassuring. They don't believe you initially, but it does happen and it comes right.
Yeah, I think that's the best advice. You did touch on one of the sleep disorders, sleep apnea, but could you say more about the different types of sleep disorders?
Yeah. So insomnia is the big one, and that's a sort of a grouping of a number of different challenges that people have. So it's sort of divided into three main types, or they used to, and I still refer to this in the way that I think. So you get what's called primary insomnia, and that's the difficulty falling asleep at night. So if you're sitting in bed, getting ready for bed, lying down and knowing that you're really going to struggle. And some people tell me, you know, they lie in bed for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, not being able to fall asleep. So that's that primary insomnia. And then you get a different type of insomnia, which is referred to as middle insomnia. So they don't have any difficulty falling asleep, but they wake up in the middle of the night and then they just can't go back to sleep. And that's a problem. And then you get what is interestingly called terminal insomnia. Now, you're not going to die from this type of insomnia, but it happens at the end of your sleep cycle. So you fall asleep okay, you stay asleep during the middle of the night, but then you wake up 2 or 3 hours earlier than you want to, and you just can't go back to sleep. So that's a real difficulty. And you know, sometimes the person will have a mix of all of those difficulties. And that can also disrupt, you know, the circadian rhythms, and people can then suffer with some forms of nightmares or some forms of sleepwalking disorders. Not that common, but, you know, some people tell me they have really interesting sojourns during the night, and they end up, in fact, my wife, when she was a child, she said she would be woken up by her parents, and she was in the wash basket down the passage and in the bathroom. So people do some interesting things when they are walking in their sleep.
And other disorders, are there still any you'd like to discuss?
Well, there's a little bit of a weird one called narcolepsy. And that's not a common one, but for those that do suffer with it, it's really, really disabling for the person because it can lead to recurrent periods of just not being able to suppress going into a sleep and, you know, just lapsing into sleep really spontaneously. And, you know, that happens during the day, happens at night. And some of the extreme forms of that is if a person suddenly gets a wave of excitement or they hear some good news or someone jumps out and says, happy birthday, surprise, that sudden shock and arousal can cause what's called cataplexy, which is a sudden loss of muscle tone. And then the person's body just sort of crumbles and then they fall into a sleep. And, you know, as I say, not very common, but it's quite disabling. You know, you can imagine people aren't allowed to drive if they are prone to just falling off and nodding off to sleep. You know, we don't want people with that challenge and disorder to be driving on our roads. So that's one of the uncommon ones. But things that people really struggle with is, you know, just daytime sleepiness. So even not to that degree of narcolepsy, you know, when people listen to this, they might think, oh, you know, I need a nap. I need a few naps during the day, or it feels like I would need a nap. And that tiredness is an accumulation of some form of sleep debt, or again, not attending to their sleep-wake cycle as they should be.
Mark, how do you approach sleep challenges in your practice?
Well, you know, thinking about it, people don't necessarily come to my office with that as the primary complaint. And I think that that's because, you know, anxiety and depression and conflicts about various marital matters or, you know, dealing with children, those are the things that bring people to therapy more often. But as I mentioned earlier, a lot of the time those emotional disorders and challenges result in sleeping disturbances. And I think that it's an omission on the part of a clinician or counselor to not ask about such, because there's a lot to be gained in containing anxiety as well as depression by having some focused time looking at a person's sleep, what they're doing before sleep, how they set themselves up, and what they do and what they think and how they manage it when they are waking up at night and complaining of those things. So each person one needs to assess individually, and when you get an assessment of what's working well and what's not working well, then it gives points at which you can intervene. And a lot of intervention requires a little bit of psychoeducation, but then also sometimes unpacking traumas that are associated with sleeping. You know, Marriott, because you can imagine if a person's had ongoing difficulties with sleep, that bed is not a comforting place because the brain associates that bed with a war zone of fighting with oneself, fighting with one's mind to switch off. And when that happens, one needs to defuse or, you know, rewire the brain, as it were, from this difficulty. And again, in that regard, nightmares being, you know, happening in the bed, people associate those nightmares with going to sleep, and they will forestall going to bed until they like literally drop off to sleep, often using alcohol, often using medications or non-prescription medications, often trying to watch television or, you know, somehow subdue their senses and distract them so that they can just drop off to sleep. But that's an unhealthy way. You know, when doing it in a better controlled way is the way to go about it. And that's what a lot of sleep hygiene discussion is all about. And then, you know, doing some trauma debriefing type work and using skills like BWRT come into that as well.
Yeah, BWRT or Brainworking Recursive Therapy is gaining ground so rapidly in South Africa, especially, but many people don't know about it. So could you explain, please?
Absolutely. So this is such an exciting topic. And, you know, I think, again, we want to anchor and give credit to Terence Watts in the UK for developing his ideas and developing this into a model of understanding an intervention that really is changing people's lives. And that's so, so exciting. And again, we also really want to give credit to Rafiq Lockett from South Africa, who has also done a lot of research, and the collaboration of Terence Watts and Rafiq Lockett has really brought BWRT into its own. And the training is happening at a really wonderful pace across the world. And more importantly than that, the results of individuals that have been the recipients of this type of therapy are just getting healed quicker, faster, and the results are often so, so permanent. It's often unbelievable. Yeah, so brain working recursive therapy is a neuroscience-based intervention where we really try and look at the problems that the brain has got, some permanent pathways, some unhealthy pathways in the brain that are perpetuating these distressing emotions, these distressing behaviors, these distressing outcomes, and we try to rewire the brain so that the outcome is as the person would prefer and would wish and would want.
Yes, I'd like to mention that I have received BWRT for some post-traumatic stress disorder myself, and I was quite blown away by how fast and effectively it worked.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you can say that to people, and I can say that to people, and there's a little bit of disbelief in people when they hear the case studies, because people don't realize that long-standing problems can really be solved in one session. And of course, that's not all the time. You know, there are really complex issues, and we need to give credence to that. But I'm just thinking now, as you say, I'm thinking of a guy not too long ago, probably about 3 months ago, who came to me, and he basically announced that he has had sleeping difficulties for his whole life. He's tried all of the different medications, and he's tried to get therapy for it, and nothing has helped. And I said, well, okay, humor me. Let's try a BWRT session, and where we specifically target that idea that he will never be able to have a good night's sleep. And 15 minutes later, he thought, okay, well, let's see. But obviously the proof is in the pudding. So I said to him, see how it goes. And interestingly, I said to him, email me, tell me how it goes. And he didn't email me for a week. And then I got an email from him. And he said to me, he resisted emailing, you know, prior, because he wanted to test out and see what actually happened. Because the first two nights, he had the best night's sleep that he had ever had after our BWRT session. The third night, he said it was a little bit problematic, but he was watching one of the rugby matches, the World World Cup South Africa rugby matches. And you all know that was last year. So it was more than a couple of months ago. And he was watching that, and he got so uptight about that, and when South Africa won by 1 point, that he had a little bit of a restless night. However, the next night again, he had the best night's sleep again, and it carried on. And then he had to email me and said, well, he doesn't know what happened, and he doesn't actually believe it, but he has been really sleeping, and he can't believe it, and he stopped his melatonin. And that's persisted. He hasn't needed to use this and the other medications. And I check in with him regularly, and it's still, without any further follow-up on that specific issue, it's maintained benefits there. Of course, everyone has other issues that do impinge at times. And so then we target the necessary with other BWRT techniques to heal and alleviate and, you know, promote health and wellness.
Yeah, and I think this is a good time for you to tell listeners about the three levels of BWRT.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, just for information, you know, when a person goes into a BWRT session, or when they see a therapist and they introduce brain working recursive therapy, they don't know how extensive the BWRT remit is, and, you know, what realm this really is, because there are three levels. And the first level are very, very powerful interventions that help with, I want to say, more simple and more straightforward issues like phobias. But I don't want to exclude the fact that when you made reference to post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, that can be really quite complex. And yet, you know, level one interventions targeting various aspects of trauma, as complex as that may be, it really makes such a huge difference to the person, and they feel instantaneous emotional relief. And that, again, inspires confidence. It inspires hope that other things that they thought they could never deal with or thought would never be resolved or fixed can get fixed. And now, before BWRT, I have to say this. I never use the word fixed. When it comes to psychological matters, you know, you want to process things, you want to help the person adapt, and you want to help them cope with it. You want to help give them tools once a panic attack comes up that they can then try to respond to that to mitigate the effects. However, when it comes to level one BWRT interventions, they fix things. They fix panic attacks. They fix those traumas, and that's so exciting. So, look, I could go on about many, many different level one interventions, but let me go to level two. So level two BWRT is there to address issues that are more of an identity difficulty. And so those are dealing with things that are probably more entrenched, probably more longstanding, probably more interconnected with their sense of who they are. And those can relate to things like long-term substance abuse, long-term, very complex personality issues, and complex post-traumatic stress disorders. And so that really addresses things that a person's identity is now in a certain line that is perpetuating these problematic series of thoughts, feelings, behaviors, interactional styles. And when one addresses that at a deeper level using the power of BWRT techniques, the person's identity shifts. And again, I'd like to highlight it's not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. You know, people have got a lot of good qualities. However, it's those things that perpetually trip them up, that keep them blocked, that limit their potential. And those are the things that are targeted so that their identity can shift in a way that can release them into being the person that they really wanted to be when the problem behavior hadn't taken residence in them and in their identity. So again, I know a lot of this is really sort of high level, just broad strokes, and that's fine. You know, you can ask me if you want further details a little bit later, but let me go on to telling you a little bit about BWRT level three. So level three BWRT is really addressing that interface between the body, you know, the real physical somatic components of the body and the mind. So it's very, very useful to support individuals who have chronic illnesses, who have got autoimmune diseases that they are living with, that they are battling with, and they've got chronic pain. And just to be clear, when it comes to BWRT level three, it's not a substitute for medical treatment. You know, it's not working against or wanting to replace the medical advice and expert input and whatever a person's been using. It's there as a support from a psychological perspective to help them endure. But not only that, to see to what degree one can really get some traction on getting them as psychologically well as possible and using their psychological fortitude to strengthen the body and to strengthen the immune system and to strengthen the mind and the body connections that can try to stimulate bodily processes that will just ease their pain, will ease their autoimmune disorders, that will contribute again to that holistic health that we're all wanting to facilitate.
Yes, and getting back to our topic, sleep challenges or disturbances, they can fit into any of those three levels easily.
Well, absolutely. So, yes, I mean, if a person's had a really bad nightmare, for instance, and that is the reason that they don't want to get into their bed, you know, and I see this often with children, you know, they have a really bad association with bed and sleep time because of that bad nightmare. And so one can use level one interventions to go in there, get them to think about the worst part of that nightmare, and then get them to desensitize themselves from that by seeing an alternative video of what they would have wanted to have done in that nightmare or to that ghost or monster, or how they would want to see that monster and capture them and tie them up or tickle them. And you know, so it's using visualization techniques in order for the person to take the sting out of whatever anxiety or nightmare or panic is causing them some difficulty. So that's just one example, I guess, of a level one intervention. When it comes to, you know, a level two intervention, as I say, sometimes people have had such enduring identity problems that they need this more extensive intervention. And when I say extensive, that doesn't mean 2 years or 5 years. It means over the course of about four sessions. Of course, you want to already always have a good assessment session or two up front. And there are uses of really structured questionnaires that are very helpful. But then getting into the work, and the important part as well is some homework. You know, people have to go back into the sleep situation and do their homework. You know, we don't expect sometimes for a miraculous turnaround. And then when they go back into the real life, they find that there are some additional problems that come up. So this is the reason why homework is important, and feedback and follow-up and checking in. And then that level three, again, if people have restless legs or if they have chronic pain or they have sleep apnea, you know, there are interventions. You know, Terence Watts has developed a BWRT. It's a level one intervention for obstructive sleep apnea. Again, it's not there to replace the recommendations of using the CPAP machines if that's all indicated, but it's again to support the person trying to move onto their side rather than lying on their back, which is going to make them more prone to having those interruptions in sleep. So as you can see, Mariette, you know, I could probably carry on talking about this and give so many different examples, but I think, again, coming back to the fact that there is hope, that if one intervention maybe at a level one doesn't work, there are probably about 20 other level one interventions that could really get some positive impact when it comes to sleeping disorders, anxiety treatment, depression treatment, and then there are level two, and then there are level three. So the variety of tools to hand is really empowering for therapists that are trained in these modalities.
I would like you, Mark, please, just to say a little more about the level one intervention for sleep apnea that you mentioned. Could you say a little more about that, please?
All right, sure. So sleep apnea, you know, there are different forms of sleep apnea, so please don't go and self-diagnose on the basis that you are snoring alone. You know, one should go to see the medics and go to a sleep clinic and get the necessary assessments done, you know, because there are obstructive sleep apneas, which is more to do with the upper airway being restricted in sleep, and it can be either partial or complete. And there is the central sleep apnea, which is more a brainstem related difficulty. So the level one interventions seek to support people who are still battling once they've got the treatment and are still struggling with the sleep apnea. And it involves buying some equipment. So having something that will wake you at night when your saturation levels, your oxygen saturation levels, SATs, S-A-T-S, when they drop below a certain threshold. Now, our oxygen saturation levels shouldn't be below 93. You know, but some people, when they hit under 90 at night, it's starting to get concerning, but particularly when it goes under 80, when it's going under 70 for brief periods of time, that's leading to hypoxia. Hypoxia is sort of brain's negative effects from starvation of oxygen. And so the idea there is to train the brain to notice when those saturation levels are declining, often augmented by sleeping on one's back. And so that little buzzer that is attached to you and it wakes you up to then get you to turn onto your side. And these BWRT interventions help you to try and condition the brain to do that more automatically so that the person is able to not have such interrupted sleep and not necessarily wake up completely to normal wakefulness to be able to then turn onto their side and continue. So that's a brief summary. There are some other additional things in the program that look at doing some tongue exercises and jaw exercises, again, just to really strengthen some of the architecture of the back of the throat where, you know, everything tends to drop and that contributes to this. So doing those toning exercises also is part of the program.
Thank you, Mark. To get back to what clients can expect from a BWRT session. For someone who knows nothing about it, could you tell them what they could expect?
Absolutely. Well, you know, when we use these big words, some people start imagining that you're going to hook them up to some fancy equipment or you've got to go to some fancy clinic. Because when I introduce this to people, they start saying, okay, where do I go? Or, you know, who do I ask to do this? And I say, no, hold on. You know, this is what we're talking about. Let me give you some introduction. So no one is ever going to catch you off guard and do a BWRT session with you. You're going to sit and you're going to discuss and hear what the client's complaint and problem is. And then during that time, as most BWRT therapists, the first thought and intervention is going to be a suggestion to do some BWRT because we know the efficacy of it. But we explain the background of how this works. And it starts with looking at the brain and understanding that there are different parts of the brain that do different things. And one of those parts helps us be trying to source out if a situation is safe or unsafe or unsure. And that's that unconscious part of the brain that is really wanting us to survive. And that when it gets triggered by something that is unsafe, our brain then goes into that fight or flight or freeze mode. And so some of the things that I'm saying right now is part of the explanation that is given to the client. And they're given some other explanations about some of the technicalities that, you know, our brain gets into certain pathways and then unconsciously we just go into panic mode when we are triggered by something that reminds us of a previous trauma. And so now what we need to do is we need to teach the brain that it doesn't need to get triggered so easily. And how we do that is we use visualization techniques. And then there's a sort of a sigh of relief. Then they say, oh, okay, so I don't have to do anything scary. And then you say no. And the nice thing about this is you can then invite them to close their eyes and visualize the difficulty that they're struggling with, not for very long, only for a few seconds really, so that they can really know and feel and get in touch with the very thing that they are battling with. And what we do then is we get them in various ways to slow that down or get a fixed point of focus so that the conscious and unconscious brain is focusing on that very disturbing image that they're battling with or that disturbing memory. And then we invite them to create a visualization of a preferred response or a preferred feeling state. And there are some other things that we also do to help them to really get the brain focused on being successful in future. And then we loop in a very fast way, getting them to circulate through those one or two or three visualization images that they have created themselves. And through that process, afterwards, there are some follow-up processes where we ask them questions. And we often use some scaling questions where we ask them, so on a scale of 0 to 10, how distressing is that for you now? And after doing some interventions, on a scale of 0 to 10, how is it for you now? And often that will come from an 8 or a 9 or a 10 down to a 5 or a 4 or a 6. And then we do some follow-up visualization techniques in a slower fashion. And over those series of things where the person's sitting comfortably in the chair opposite the therapist, just closing their eyes, that PAL score, that rating of 0 to 10 comes down slowly but surely. And when they open their eyes, they say, sure, that was amazing, or that was interesting, or sure, lots happened for me there. And I love that, you know, because processing a little bit afterwards is so, so important. And you see the relief in the person. You see there's a change in their eyes. You look into their eyes, there's a difference. And that's because the brain working recursive therapy technique that is used, it really heals and fixes those neural pathways that are triggering them. And it creates and rewires the brain in such a powerful way, not because the therapist tells them what they should be thinking or responding or feeling differently, but because the client themselves are generating their preferred responses and emotions. And so that's so important, that no one confuses this with hypnosis or a therapist trying to insert ideas into a person's mind. It is absolutely not that. It is the person taking control, often for the first time, of focusing on the very scary images or thoughts that they're battling with, or just those problems that have been there that they've just acclimatized themselves to. Okay, they're going to take residence in my mind, in my psyche, in my behavior, and they never challenge them. And so this BWRT process works using visualization, using some fast repetition of those scenarios that they create and they're working on. And at the end of it, there's this relief and the sigh of wonder at how come I, when I'm thinking about this nightmare now, why can't I get affected? Why is my heart not racing? Why are my palms not sweaty? And we encourage them to trigger that and say, well, let's see. Did it work? Let's not wait. Let's see. Did it work? If it was something like a nightmare, if it was something like a burglary that happened when the person was in the middle of the night and they woke up and they saw the intruder at the window, and that haunts them, and they keep waking up at that time, if one can work with that and then they think about that and no longer get those heart palpitations and physiological arousals associated, they know it's changed, it's different. And that is, there's no homework when it comes to those processes. It's done, it's fixed, and they go back into the situation and they're amazed.
And the wonderful thing is that it can be done online.
Yes. You know, again, prior to me being trained in this, I would have expressed disbelief. You know, I've been a qualified psychologist for over 20 years. And, you know, if someone had told me that you could do some visualization exercises in 15 minutes and it can have permanent effects without you really knowing what the person is working on, without going into like 7 sessions worth of debriefing and unpacking, and you can do it online on video, you can do it over the telephone. I've had to do that over the telephone with someone, an adolescent up in another part of the world, and he just lost Wi-Fi connection and he couldn't put his video on. And some people as well, they just prefer not having their video on. And it's so empowering to know that I can help them. I can treat them using these techniques over the phone, audio. I can do it over video. And we can even work on things that the person doesn't want to tell you about. You know, because a lot of people, when it comes to sleep disturbances, you know, you can imagine there are a lot of associations with sleeping and bed and nocturnal activities. And people that carry a lot of shame, a lot of guilt of things in their past, they don't want to talk about those things in detail or at all. And BWRT is a technique that, surprise, surprise, allows a person to process and fix past situations that cause them a lot of shame, a lot of trauma, a lot of guilt, even when they do not tell the therapist what they're working on. So they need not disclose all the gory details, the ins and the outs. You can do it over cell phone. You can do it over the internet, on WhatsApp, on Zoom. Obviously, we want a private and a secure platform for client confidentiality. But, you know, on those urgent emergency moments, you know, WhatsApp video works. And so it's just so exciting. It's so versatile. It's so available to help people. And you know, the nice thing about this is because it allows for the client to share as much or as little as they want, which, by the way, is called contentless, you know, working in a contentless fashion.
Mm-hmm.
What's so nice about that is if a family member needed some quick intervention, so if one of my family members needed intervention, or a friend, whereas in the past, I would say, no, it's a dual role here. I'm too close to the situation. You know, I need to get someone who's more distant and independent. Well, you know what? If they take responsibility for knowing that they don't have to share anything traumatic with me, if I feel it appropriate, I can intervene and I can help them so much. And friends appreciate it, family members appreciate it. I use it on my family and my children all the time to support them. And it's, again, I just want to highlight, it's not something that should be seen as a complicated, scary thing to do, because I don't want the listeners out there to think, well, I need to prepare myself for this fancy, amazing, hardcore therapy. It's something that works with you. It's something that works really well. It can change your life.
It can. And I'd like you to say more about working with children and teens, so listeners will understand that children take to this, right? And teens too.
Absolutely. You know, if we go back to the idea that it's largely a visualization exercise where the person sitting in front of you, the client, they need to just picture and imagine scenes, either memories or future scenes that worry them, but then to come up with a creative visualization as a solution or as a preferred response. And adults sometimes are a little bit staid and a little bit inflexible, a little bit rigid, although, you know, 99% of the people I see, the adults I'm talking about, slot into it immediately. But children are amazing. You know, their mind is ready for creative thought. Their mind is not obstructed by all of the limitations that the world and practicalities impinge on one. So, you know, their creative thought, their magical thinking can be used to such therapeutic effect. It's amazing.
And Mark, what should parents look out for regarding sleep disturbances? When should they consider this intervention regarding their children?
Yeah, so like I think with anything, if a parent is tuned in with their children and they start to notice changes or differences in their approach to their sleep, in their, you know, sustaining a good night's sleep, then they need to start monitoring what is going on. And obviously, if parents can, you know, run through, I guess, some sort of a rational process of eliminating obvious causes, then they can do that and they don't need to come for therapy if it's a short, brief, you know, aberration in the child's usual way that they sleep. So, for example, you know, if it's exam time and the child is getting stressed, that trigger is obviously the exams. But if it carries on and it becomes a learned pattern, then one wants to get some intervention there. If nightmares, you know, everyone has nightmares now and again. Everyone has interesting and weird dreams. In fact, I recorded all of my dreams over a period of 2 years and I journaled them. That's a topic for another day. But the point is, everyone does dream. Everyone has some nightmares now and again, but that doesn't necessarily constitute a reason that one should rush to a therapist. When those nightmares or sleep disturbances become interfering of the child's functioning in the day or at night, or, you know, the child is constantly waking up and creeping into the bed of the parents, you know, there's some attachment issues, some anxiety issues, you know, one or two nights, depending on the age of the child, is okay. You know, we all go through some steps forward, some steps back, but if there is a persistence, if it is developmentally inappropriate for the child, and those behaviors are not functional, not healthy, not good for the child, not good for the parents, not good for the whole family, then one needs to then consider referral. And again, let me again plug the medical in and go back to that whole thing, biopsychosocial. So for the parent to think about, is there a possible medical condition? You know, if a child is struggling with some enuresis, which is wetting their bed, we don't know if that could be due to a bladder infection. You know, it could be due to some diabetes. It could be due to an onset of epilepsy. It could be due to emotional factors, but we don't want to assume it's emotional until the medics, you know, just have apply their mind and have a checkout. That being excluded, of course, if it persists, one wants to address it and see what the emotional triggers are and address that. And the parents would do well to seek counsel, to seek advice, bring their child in, get the child to, if you know, depending on the age, to draw, to act out what they are feeling or seeing or experiencing. You know, because children, you want to be a little bit more tactile, you want to be a bit more concrete, you want to be a bit more interactive and fun. And so there is a little bit more preparation work with children than with adults, who can, you know, just go into things a lot quicker sometimes. But as I say, when children get it and they go for it, the results are so, so encouraging. And it can really allow the parents to have their good night's sleep back and not worry about the children and the long-term effects of these problems that they see with their children. They're feeling helpless. We don't want people to feel helpless. I think that's the thing, is when people, parents, children start feeling helpless, that helplessness contributes to a depression or anxiety, and we don't want that. If we can nip it in the bud, go to the expert, go to a BWRT-trained therapist, get the assessment, get the intervention, monitor it, give feedback, and get those situations fixed.
Thank you, Mark. I will attach various websites to this episode, including South African and international websites where people can find BWRT-trained practitioners. But I would like to ask you where listeners can learn more about your work.
Oh, right. Yes. So I guess people tend to Google these days, don't they? So typing in Google, you'll probably find Mark Eaton, clinical psychologist, neuropsychologist. But I do have a site at payhip.com, spelled payhip.com/ Mark Eaton, one word, with capital M and capital E. And in fact, you asked me about children and teens. There is actually a downloadable 2-hour, what would I call it? It was basically it was sharing on how parents, how teachers can intervene with children and teens that are struggling with anxiety. And as we know, anxiety can lead to a lot of sleep disturbance. So if the listeners want to go and check that out, they can have a look at that on my website at payhip.com/ Mark Eaton. And any other products and any other articles that I am encouraged to do, I will upload there as well.
Thank you, Mark. And as I said, I will attach that link to the podcast as well. Could you now give us your 3 nice sleep tips, please?
Oh, yes. Okay. So I guess one can summarize them, and there's probably a more detailed version. But, you know, one thing, thankfully, I sleep pretty well. As mentioned, my first child gave me a bit of a wake-up call, pardon the pun. But when I have had those moments of, I guess, sometimes excitement, if I've been, you know, I'm a musician as well. So when I've played at various functions in front of lots of people, you know, it's a rush. And so sometimes going to bed and trying to switch off that rush is a little difficult. And a lot of people with sleeping difficulties find as well, they can't switch off their brain, even with positive things. And so something that I've learned to do and I find useful is, firstly, not to fight it. Sleep is a bit of a paradoxical thing. The more you try to fall asleep, the more it eludes you. Mm. And so you've actually got to do something else in order to fall asleep. And so when the mind is very overactive, what I suggest to people is to try and, you know, roll with the punches and actually try to put your thoughts on hyperdrive. So what you do is you try and think of so many different images to flood your brain so that it actually, you know, the brain starts to say, hold on, slow down, I don't want to do this. But you're consciously throwing images of Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, thinking about a tractor, completely unrelated images that don't make a lot of sense. And you keep on throwing those in hyperdrive at your brain, as it were, that the brain says, halt, 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 slow down, slow down, slow down. And when you start to fatigue from that, you pick it up again. And eventually your brain just says, I've had enough, I'm shutting down. And then it sort of helps you to then take a few deep breaths and slip off into sleep. So that's one. Now, the other two, I'm going to give Terence Watts a plug, because I've seen him recommend these two, and people, you know, respond to these exceptionally well as well. The first one is imagining, if you're struggling to fall asleep at night, imagining being in an elevator where you're looking up at the LED floor number, and it's in a skyscraper, so you start on about 300 or 200, you pick a number, but what you do is you sort of see yourself verbalizing the numbers as you push that button. It's going down to 299, 298, all the way down. And you'll notice that, you know, if you imagine your eyes looking up at an elevator number above, it actually, you're pulling your eyes to the back of your brain, which also makes it feel heavier. And also by counting down and not counting sheep, by the way, please don't count sheep. So those listeners, don't count sheep. Well, it might work for some, but counting upwards somehow just stimulates the brain. So counting downwards, imagining you're in an elevator going down, often does the trick. The next one is sort of embellishing on that idea, but seeing yourself in a busy shopping center where there's a hustle and bustle. And I guess this is a metaphor for what's going on in your brain. But you're walking around, bumping into people, and it's really irritating. And then you see off in the distance an escalator. And so you navigate slowly to that escalator, get on the escalator, and you go down the escalator, and you get to the next floor of this multi-layered complex shopping mall. And this level is a little bit quieter, fewer people, but it's still a bit busy. And then you navigate to the next escalator, and so on and so on, until it gets quieter and quieter. And then Terence adds a very interesting and inspired little idea that at the bottom of this center, you see a bed store, and you go in there and you see the most comfortable of beds with the most comfortable of pillows, and you jump on that bed and you just relax into it. And often by that time, you've fallen asleep already. But if needs be, you can imagine having a dream about being in a shopping center that's busy and finding that escalator and going down and down, quieter and quieter. And it just invites the brain into that peaceful sleep that we all so desire.
It's the first time ever I've heard sleep tips that sound like fun.
Well, yeah, it has to be fun. Why not? You know, sleep is so important. It's a joy to sleep. So, you know, having fun activities as well lightens the mood. It gives you a sense of controllability. And then by doing these things, you're not forcing yourself to sleep. You're doing and focusing on something that is fun, that is enjoyable. And a byproduct of that is the relaxation that leads you off into wonderland, slumberland. Yeah.
Thank you, Mark. And speaking about fun, can I ask you your fun question?
All right. I'm curious to know what that fun question is, so fire away.
When I say chopsticks, Mark, what comes to mind?
Oh, sushi. I remember my son and I going to a sushi place and sharing a lovely bowl of sushi together. Yeah, so that's the association for me.
Thank you, Mark, for taking us on this journey. When you and I were talking about the podcast before we recorded, you mentioned that humans are the only animals who will store sleep, because I suppose we have fear of missing out. So So it's quite a complicated subject. Thank you very much for illuminating it so well, and especially for the good news that there is help.
Yes, no, there is. You know, Mariette, you're correct. I do need to say I did do some research after our discussion about, you know, human beings forestalling sleep. But apparently there are some birds when they are migrating, they don't sleep. And I guess it would be it would not be in their favor to fall off to sleep while they're busy migrating. And apparently, interesting fact here, some dolphins and whales, what they do is while they are needing to catch up on sleep, they can actually have what's called hemispheric sleep. So one part of their brain goes to sleep while the other part is awake. And so there are some, you know, the world out there is so fascinating and wonderful. And the world of sleep can be very, very complex for those that are suffering, either on a primary level, you know, with primary insomnia being the main condition or difficulty, or as a secondary to all of the other emotional complaints.
Mm. Thank you, Mark. And to our listeners, it was good of you to join us. I'd be honored if you'd subscribe to this podcast series and rate it where you download your podcasts. If this episode inspired you, please share it with someone you care about. Go to my website, www.marietsneeman.co.za, for this episode's podcast notes and for free articles and podcast episodes on how to live a happier life and have more fulfilling relationships. To follow me on Facebook, just search for Mariette Sneeman Journalist. Calm, Clear and Helpful is compiled, hosted and edited by me, with original music by Mart Marie Sneeman. Catch you next Tuesday at 9:00.